Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Siva Vaidyanathan.
Everyone, welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, April 16th. Before we get started, I want to introduce my co-host for the next 2 weeks, Siva Vaidyanathan. He's the director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. He's also the author of a book called Antisocial Media, How Facebook Disconnects Us and Undermines Democracy. It's a great book. I've read it. And also the book, The Googleization of Everything. Siva, thanks so much for co-hosting.
Oh, my pleasure, April. You know, I've been a guest on this show, and this is just a great honor, and I look forward to having some fun here.
Yeah. And so this is our first week. Next week will hopefully be a little more, even more ironed out and more used to this. On today's show, we're going to talk about India's ongoing election and how parties are taking advantage of social media to spread propaganda to voters in the world's biggest democracy. Then we'll talk about Uber's decision to take the company public despite massive legal disputes with its workforce over their employment status and the fact that the company is hemorrhaging an eye-popping $1.8 billion a year.
After that, I will talk to Andy Greenberg, a senior writer for Wired, about the recent indictment of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. I'll discuss the details of the U.S. indictment against him, as well as Assange's strange ideological trajectory from radical transparency activist to a collaborator with Russia during Trump's bid for the White House.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw on the web this week. That's all coming up on If Then. Okay, Siva, so it's so great to have you as a co-host and not as somebody that we're interviewing, because I just learned that you used to be a journalist before you were a professor, book writer, social media critic.
Yeah, I was a journalist back in the analog 20th century when we had these large sheets of paper that would have ink on them, and that is how we delivered information to the people.
A newspaper man before the podcast gold rush.
Right, exactly.
and before social media, which has become your fixation. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Siva has written multiple books about some of the world's largest companies, Google and Facebook primarily. Have you written other books too? Or
I have. I started out writing books about copyright and intellectual property. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Wrote a book about Napster, wrote a book about the history of American copyright law, and copyright drew me into Google because, of course, the library scanning project was so fascinating. And then Google drew me into Facebook, and somehow I ended up on this show.
Well, it's just wonderful to have such a well-rounded expert on so many of the issues that we talk about. But we're going to start today actually talking about something that you have expertise on, but isn't directly about Google and Facebook, but rather about the phenomena that is democracy in India and the elections that are happening right now. When did they start?
Well, so the voting for the general national elections in India started just this week, but they will go on through different segments until May 23rd. May 23rd will be the day that the results of the election will come forth. And so India, with a population of 1.3 billion people, has about 900 million registered voters, and they almost all vote every election. It's pretty stunning to think about that kind of turnout, right? And they're voting across 29 states. They're voting in more than 15 languages.
Wow.
You know, it's an amazing activity. It's like this pageant of democracy that occurs about every 5 years, but you know, it's a parliamentary system, so sometimes more frequently. And they're, you know, they're electing their full Congress, both houses of their parliament, actually, what they call the Lok Sabha and the Rajya Sabha, the lower house and the upper house. And they all vote. And since the 1990s, they have all voted on secure electronic machines. And because illiteracy is high in India, people tend to vote for the symbol of their party, and they use these secure voting machines. And the machines are so well designed and have been designed by computer scientists over the years and tested that there is remarkably high level of faith in the results of the election. So contrast that to the United States, where we can't seem to get it together on how we should vote. We have no national standards for voting. We have no, we barely have enforceable state levels. We have terribly insecure electronic machines when we choose to use them. And every 2 to 4 years, we have a series of close elections that seem to indicate some sort of meltdown in trust. So India has mastered the trust question when it comes to the actual process of voting. But the other really fascinating thing about India is it is, first of all, Facebook's biggest market with more than 300 million regular Facebook users. And almost every one of them is also a WhatsApp user. So WhatsApp and Facebook are taking over the media ecosystem in India, and they are carrying the worst content, the worst garbage, right? Harassments and calls to harassment and calls to lynchings and mass violence and lots of conspiracy stuff. A lot of it aimed at the Muslim population, which is about 15% of the population of India. A lot of it aimed at Christians. A lot of it aimed at liberals or women or LGBTQ activists. And so you have this really corrosive public sphere, a deeply insecure culture of democracy, but you have the actual mechanics of democracy working so well. I think if we paid close attention to what goes on in India, we in the United States could learn both how to avoid tipping into the cesspool of nonsense that flows around Indian politics. At the same time, we could probably learn how we might run the actual instruments of elections or technologies of elections a lot better.
So I want to go back to something you, one of the first things that you said or started talking about was that the technology that's used to vote in India elections has not had serious security scares, which is just mind-boggling to me, because in the U.S. it was only after the 2016 elections that our election infrastructure was considered kind of part of our critical national infrastructure and therefore would get national kind of security attention. And we have to realize that so many machines across the U.S. are running on Windows XP, are known to be incredibly hackable. I mean, we've seen them actually hacked on the floor of Congress to run Pac-Man, you know, and they haven't been improved since then in many cases. We've seen our voter registration rolls get hacked. So we're dealing with just an incredibly porous and vulnerable system. But jumping to the other thing that you mentioned, which is that whereas the Indian government seems to have their tech under control in some ways, or in most ways it appears, where the U.S. comes into the India elections has been a mess, and that has been through the company that is Facebook, which also owns WhatsApp, and that's been a kind of a cesspool of disinformation. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Like in 2014, the BJP, which is the current ruling party of India at a national level, and their leader, Narendra Modi, exploited Facebook really deftly. They figured out that Facebook is the best possible way to very carefully aim messages at certain segments of the population. Facebook itself will do all that work for you. You can motivate people in all sorts of ways that are kind of invisible to any sort of public scrutiny. And you can make sure to get your message to the right people. And they did that so effectively that they swept to this massive electoral victory in 2014. So now Modi's up for re-election. His economy is sputtering. His plans for reform have all basically fallen apart. He's not been able to do what he promised for people. So there's real concern among his partisans that he's losing support and the BJP is losing support. At the same time, all of the other parties running against him have taken to Facebook and WhatsApp to distribute their propaganda. The result may be a different party running India, but the long-term result is terrible for democracy. Whenever you see political communication retreat to these private spheres, these uninterrogatable communication networks, you lose any sense of public debate and public conversation about the issues. It all becomes about who can motivate their own people to rile up hatred and anger to go vote and, you know, or do worse, right? Harass or commit violence against some other group in society. So what you're seeing in India is, you know, the numbers of democracy couldn't be better, but the quality of democracy, right? So the quantity of democracy couldn't be better. Mm-hmm, the quality of democracy in India could not be worse.
Right. And, and of course, Facebook's problems in India will continue likely long after the elections are concluded. And Facebook is not only having problems in India in places where it didn't originate. It's also having problems in Myanmar, in many countries. It's really just been used as a tool for hate. But we need to move on now to some other news here in the U.S., but touches around the world still. And that is about Uber, which last Thursday released its hotly anticipated prospectus for being publicly traded on the stock market. Uber could reach a value of $100 billion. And just for comparison, earlier this year, Uber's arch rival Lyft went public in March at $24 billion. So we're just looking at a massive IPO here. In its filing to the Securities and Exchange Commission last week, the company shared that while it may fetch this astronomical value, this $100 billion value, the company is still burning cash at an uncontrollable rate, it seems. Uber lost $1.8 billion in 2018. Despite that, its revenue clocked in at $11 billion. But, losing $1.8 on top of that is just, I just can't even fathom the amount of money that this company is hemorrhaging.
It seems like the risk to Uber and its investors is so much higher than it is with any comparable company because of that valuation, right? But also because of its global spread. I mean, what is it about where Uber makes money and where Uber matters that might leave it vulnerable in the next few years?
Yeah, so one thing that a lot of details were shared in its public offering filings, including the fact that 24%, so almost a quarter of Uber's bookings, are in five cities. That's New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, London, and Sao Paulo in Brazil. And that means that those cities have tremendous regulatory leverage over the company. So and we've already seen, New York change the way drivers are classified. That was after big regulatory disputes in the city with the mayor. If we see other cities, clamp down on how, this company and rideshare companies or just in general gig economy companies are treated, it could really affect Uber. I mean, they're just massively dependent. Also, 15% of bookings apparently come from airport trips. So if airports decide that they don't want to cooperate or they no longer wish to work with these companies or disallow them from servicing the airport, that will have a tremendous impact. So, I just didn't realize how sensitive the business model was.
And we know that the biggest problem with Uber is its labor force. The biggest threat to Uber is its labor force, right? It has all these independent contractor drivers. And we know they're on the record. Uber's on the record basically saying it would like to get rid of them. It would like to eventually have driverless vehicles. So it seems like it's in a race with this burn rate of $1.8 billion a year to maintain some cash as it transforms itself from a ride-sharing company using human drivers to an autonomous vehicle company somewhere down the line. What do you see is going on with the labor situation with Uber?
Right. One thing that I'm glad that you brought up the kind of robot car aspirations, kind of taking humans out of the element, because Uber has not been treating its drivers as employees. They're not employees. They're contractors. And people who work for Uber, that means that they don't receive health care. They don't have a guaranteed minimum wage. They cannot unionize. It's very difficult to organize. And according to Uber's filing, 60,000 Uber drivers already have or intend to dispute their contractor status with the company. And this is in addition to a class action lawsuit this year that was finalized that paid $20 million to drivers that claimed that they were misclassified. And that was something like over 13,000 drivers that were within that class. So, it's going to be really interesting to see how Uber's bid plays out. I mean, like I said, we're looking at many, many billions of dollars on the line here, and really something that could really transform a lot of people into millionaires overnight. And they're just really hinged on a lot of things that could kind of move under the company's feet. But I think that is all we have to say on the IPO now, because when we get back, Siva has a fascinating conversation with Andy Greenberg, one of my favorite journalists and senior writer for Wired, about the recent indictment of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, our guest today is Andy Greenberg, a senior writer for Wired, who covers security and privacy, information freedom, and hacker culture. He's also the author of the book This Machine Kills Secrets, which is about WikiLeaks and about hacktivists and cryptography, among other things. So, Andy Greenberg, thank you for joining us on If Then today.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Right. So, on Thursday, for the first time in 7 years, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange left the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he sought refuge from a standing arrest warrant in the UK for skipping bail. He was also avoiding extradition to the United States for his WikiLeaks work in helping to release hundreds of thousands of highly classified documents, which included details of war crimes from the U.S. military in collaboration with former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. He was also at the time dodging accusations of rape and sexual assault in Sweden, although those charges had been, or the investigation had been, suspended. But in the run-up to the 2016 election, WikiLeaks published a trove of emails stolen off the Democratic National Committee servers by Russian intelligence agents, which inarguably led to serious damaging repercussions for the Clinton campaign and helped the campaign of President Donald Trump. So, Andy, maybe you could start and help us out with describing what exactly Assange faces if he is sent to the United States, if he gets extradited from the United Kingdom.
Well, what we've seen so far is an indictment that is, I think, 6 pages long. That's very short, and it's rather thin, as some, or at least one hacker defense attorney has described it to me. Assange specifically is accused, and I think this is really the only concrete crime charged in the indictment, with helping Chelsea Manning to crack a password that she sent to him in a kind of hashed form, which is a kind of like a light form of encryption, to put it like probably in a technically incorrect way, but layman's terms. Yeah. She passed him this hashed password. He said, I will try to crack this for you. And a couple of days later, she checked with him. He said that he still hadn't cracked it. But just the offer of having cracked it is enough to be part of a conspiracy to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And that carries 5 years in prison in the United States if he were convicted of this. But there are, you know, that is really the extent of the criminal behavior that he's charged with. And there are a lot of questions that remain around whether that will stick.
Do we have any reason to believe at this point any evidence that he actually cracked that password or took some action that got Manning closer to cracking that password?
It looks, in fact, from the indictment. So there, we now have two documents from the Department of Justice. The indictment, which was filed in March of 2018, and then an affidavit from an FBI agent that was filed in December of 2017. The indictment basically makes it sound like Assange failed to crack the password, but implies that he tried. And that would be enough, I think, to be a conspirator. But the earlier document, this affidavit that just came out yesterday, it was just unsealed yesterday, and was dated December 2017. And in that document, the FBI, the Department of Justice, basically admits that they have no evidence that he even tried. So it's not just that he probably failed to crack the password. It may be that he just told Manning he was going to try and never did. You know, Assange is not the most forthright guy in the world. It's very conceivable that he might have told Manning he was going to try this just to keep her feeding him information. And then he got busy with other things, or he never really did try, or maybe he didn't really have the password cracking capabilities, the tools that he said he did. Who knows? And I think that to actually put him in prison, the Department of Justice is probably going to have to prove that he didn't just say he would do this, but that he actually did.
Right. And in fact, there's a pretty high barrier right now. I mean, it's one thing to get an indictment on an accusation under something like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. But it's another thing to be able to show a court in the United Kingdom that there is cause to return Assange to the United States or send Assange to the United States to face this charge. Now, the CFAA is a law that was first passed in 1984. It's been revised a few times, including as part of the USA Patriot Act immediately after the attacks of 9/11/2001. And it's been used to prosecute people for all sorts of nefarious acts or contributions to nefarious acts. It's been used against cyberbullies who were, you know, using MySpace to bully teens. It's been used by to prosecute a Goldman Sachs programmer for copying code that was used for high-frequency trading. It's been used to prosecute Aaron Swartz, an activist and a programmer, a hacker who you know, helped create some of the most, you know, powerful movements against excessive copyright. And he ended up suffering so greatly under the prosecution because he had been able to crack some password encryptions and unleash thousands of academic articles from a collection known as JSTOR. And he was prosecuted under it in 2011. And ultimately, he ended up ending his own life in 2013. So what is your sense of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and its role, not only in the Assange case, but in, you know, when it comes to all of these various activities of computer crime or something close to computer crime?
Well, there's no question that the CFAA is a problematic law. It's been overbroad, understood to be overbroad for years, if not decades. That was a great list that you had of all of the people who have had questionable and high-profile CFAA indictments, but it left off Matthew Keyes and Barrett Brown, two journalists who have been charged under the CFAA. Matthew Keyes, I believe, passed a password for his network to some members of LulzSec or Anonymous. Simply passing that password was enough for him to spend years in prison. Barrett Brown was accused of sharing a link to stolen files, I believe, in an anonymous chat room. So merely sharing a link to stolen files was what started his investigation. I believe that he was then charged in addition with threatening a federal agent. But both of those are cases of actual journalists. I mean, we can argue about this beaten to death question of whether Assange is a journalist, but Matthew Keyes and Barrett Brown absolutely consider themselves journalists and are more traditional journalists, have, you know, written for mainstream publications. And they were both charged with the CFAA for these kind of tenuous acts. And I think Assange now is falling into that bucket more than any other CFAA defendants I've seen.
Yeah. And, you know, we've also seen in recent years, since the rise of WikiLeaks, or maybe the fall of WikiLeaks, we've seen other journalistic organizations set up repositories for people to donate some, you know, seized material securely. So we've seen other examples of actual, you know, more mainstream or legitimate journalistic organizations engage in practices that aren't too far from WikiLeaks, or at least modeled upon WikiLeaks. Of course, the actual project of publication of these documents is very different. WikiLeaks does massive dumps of data that we're all supposed to make sense of and sort through, whereas journalistic organizations will vet and check and certify and be very careful about whom they expose through the publication of this information. What do you see are the threats to press freedoms in the United States with this prosecution of Assange? Should journalists be worried? I mean, any more than they should have been over the past 10 or 15 years?
I don't know. I mean, the Department of Justice has successfully kind of separated Assange from the pack before taking him down by focusing on this one act that I do think is not what journalists do, you know, helping to crack a password or offering to help to crack a password. And that's is that because it's criminal, or because it's what hackers do instead of journalists, or is it just because most journalists don't have rainbow tables, like this kind of software tool that you use to crack a hashed password? I think it's just as likely that it's the latter. You know, as a lot of the things that Assange did first, as you say, like hosting a anonymous Dropbox that uses a Tor hidden service this cryptographic tool to cut the forensic trace of the source. That has been adopted by newsrooms around the world. You know, in many ways, Assange has just brought a hacker mentality to the act of journalism. In this case, he has done something nobody else has done, but everything else that he does, like, you know, the act of conspiring with a source is something that journalists do all the time in a kind of non-legal definition. So, and sources are breaking the law. They're leaking classified information that they're not supposed to, and we're conspiring with them. So it is worrying. The line is so ill-defined. And it seems like the Department of Justice has tried to just like kind of desperately latch on to one thing that Assange does that's unique to make him a criminal and not a journalist. But the fact is that, you know, most of what he does, and in fact, most of what's in the indictment even, is stuff that all journalists do, or a lot of investigative adversarial journalists do.
Right. And of course, conspiracy charges are often built upon acts that are otherwise innocent or common. Like, you can drive a bank robber to a bank, and driving's not illegal, and driving a person's not illegal, but that it's part of a conspiracy or part of a criminal act makes it part of a conspiracy. So that would be the prosecutor's argument, that normal, everyday, common activities can be swept into this. So I'm wondering also about, you know and followed Assange and WikiLeaks better than just about anybody. What's your sense of the story? I mean, the Julian Assange we saw taken out of the Ecuadorian embassy and put into a police car, you know, with his full beard, you know, reminded me of sort of late Orson Welles. So, are we looking at a late Orson Welles figure, and how does that contrast with the Assange we knew in the early years of the 21st century? And how have you seen him change, his mission change, the mission of WikiLeaks change? Has he undergone an ideological shift, or has he been fairly consistent and just our concerns have shifted over time?
I think that there have certainly been different Assanges over the years. And the one that I interviewed in 2010, which is really the last time I did a big substantive interview with him. After that, I had these brief conversations with him, which mostly consisted of him yelling at me about stuff that he thought I had been unfair to him about. So since 2010, he has become, I think, a really different person and has drastically shifted WikiLeaks activities. And I think that a lot of it is just that he holds grudges. He's, becomes obsessed with settling scores, and his enemy list has just like burgeoned over the years, to the point where it seems like he, in 2016, I can't psychoanalyze him, but it certainly seemed like he was more interested in attacking Hillary than leaking anything about Trump, who we know has massive secrets to leak. And he seemed entirely uninterested because he had, I don't really know why, I have to admit, but it's all too easy to see that he had a score to settle with Clinton. He had published blog posts, kind of just strange, subjective, screeds about her warmongering. And I think that he believed that she was going to put him in prison and chose a side. And that is, I think, somewhat different from the Assange that I knew in 2010, who was more idealistic, less bitter, I think was a more admirable person in his principles. And I mean that in a way that I think is distinct from the fact that he has shifted in his allegiance from ostensibly like left-leaning people to the right.
So one person who has remained fairly consistent throughout this whole saga is Chelsea Manning, who finds herself once again in jail. She's been jailed for refusing to answer to a grand jury subpoena to testify ostensibly against Julian Assange. And Manning had been released from federal prison after President Obama commuted her 35-year sentence. So how do you see the relationship between Manning and Assange? And do you see Manning as someone who's been consistent in her principles throughout this?
I think she has been, and I think that is different from Assange. Assange has done hypocritical things. Like, he has, for instance, threatened to sue WikiLeaks staff of his own organization if they leak secrets. He has had a television show that was funded by the Russian state on Russia Today. Whereas I think Chelsea Manning has remained true to her principles. She thought this information needed to get out, and she got it out. She in some ways has an easier job than Assange. Assange is on different sides of different issues all the time, whereas she really just was trying to get information out about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in the State Department. And you can criticize the decision to do that if you like. And certainly I do think that those leaks were reckless in some way. The fact that WikiLeaks eventually, by accident, it seems, leaked all of the State Department cables, even when they were trying to redact them, seems like that can be traced back to Chelsea Manning's decision to give them all to someone who may not be able to protect them. And that caused State Department sources to have to flee their countries to receive extra protection, to experience fear, if not harm. So that's serious. But I do think that at least Chelsea Manning's principles have remained internally consistent, whereas Assange has, I think, I would say, betrayed some of them.
Well, Andy Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us today on If Then.
I was really glad to be here. It's a great conversation. Thanks.
One final quick break, and then don't close my tab. Some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
It's time again for Don't Close My Tabs, where we talk about the best things we've seen online this week. But first, we want to tell you about a new feature on Slate's website that can help you keep track of the tabs we recommend. It's called the Slate Podcast Endorse-O-Matic. That's such a funny thing to call it. It's very, very 50s. But if you go to the site slate.com/endorsements, you'll find a searchable database with all the tabs we've recommended, as well as recommendations from other Slate podcast hosts. That's, again, slate.com/endorsements. Check it out. Okay, Siva, let's start with you. Never a slow news day. What tab do you still have open that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, you know, this is my first time playing this game, Don't Close My Tab. So I decided to go kind of old school, like early web. And I chose a Wikipedia page, the Wikipedia page for Notre Dame. I was rolling through Twitter, looking at all the people who were commenting on what had been going on with the fire at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. And I came across a tweet from a security researcher, a network scientist at the University of Colorado. His name is Brian Keegan. And he pointed out that the Wikipedia page for Notre Dame in only 6 hours had more than 660 revisions from 219 unique editors writing 22 kilobytes of content, including images and video and maps. Links to articles, 35 different language editions were pouring out. You know, the French edition had 483 revisions from 120 editors in a matter of 6 hours. You know, what we see here is this army of committed people trying to, with a sort of flurry of activity and energy, and I'm sure way too much caffeine, produce the highest quality possible real-time account of what's going on, following Wikipedia's very stringent rules about what should be cited and what should be counted as authoritative. So the conversation pages for the for the Notre Dame site are fascinating in itself, right? Those conversation pages, someone could write a whole dissertation about. Here you have this major breaking event with worldwide attention. It's being covered in multiple languages by editors, all of whom share a principle or a set of principles about what should be on Wikipedia. It reminds me that the spirit of Wikipedia and the spirit of the Wikipedia community could have been the model for the World Wide Web. And there was a moment in time when we thought it might grow to be where everybody was donating their time and committed to spreading the best possible information. Unfortunately, it hasn't turned out that way. And the Wikipedia model, though, remains strong, remains with us, and remains essential.
Yeah, you know, Wikipedia, I believe, is I think it's the fifth largest or most trafficked website in the world. And of course, it's kind of like the definitional, it's the answer to so many of our Google queries. And it's a nonprofit. It does, though, as we know, have a problem with its editors being, primarily male and primarily white or from, America or European countries. But I agree, I've been studying, going back to this project I used to be involved in called Indie Media, which was also a very participatory, collaborative internet project back in the early aughts. And I'm fascinated by, what these volunteer communities can create. I mean, again, the fifth largest website in the world. I think that's it. So I have to check again. But this massive site is made by, volunteers. It's just phenomenal. I know that they're actively working on diversifying it more, and they have been for some time, for a long, long time. They know this is a problem because, if the people who are writing these definitions are of a single group. But Wikipedia is often, it's like vastly, usually, it's like high 90s, like correct. It's usually right. It's as correct as the Encyclopedia Britannica. So for my tab, I actually want to talk about something that you are an expert on, and that is Google. There was a article that came out this weekend in the New York Times, a fantastic article by Jennifer Valentino Daviris, I think I said her name correctly, Tracking Phones, Google is a Dragnet for the Police. And it is about a new type of warrant that Google is honoring from police that is this kind of geofencing range warrant where the police can ask for a list of devices that Google happens to have location history tracking on for that were in a certain area at a particular time and then narrow that down to particular devices. And Google has been honoring those warrant requests. And this is just huge because, one thing that came out in the article is that somebody was arrested in part based from information that law enforcement had retrieved showing that he was on the scene of where a crime happened or that his phone was somehow. And it was something that he did not do and he was in jail for some number of days, because just, where your phone happened to tick where it was doesn't, make anyone suspicious necessarily or guilty. And it's just, Google has made such a big ado over the years, and you probably know the history of this better than me, of fighting and pushing back against police requests for data. And here we see a new type of warrant popping up.
And the thing is, Google doesn't have to keep this data. Like, it can do just fine without this one more layer of personal information and tracking, right? It actually did okay before it had this layer of tracking. And it seems to do okay even when it is restricted in what it gathers. But Google continues to grab whatever it can grab regardless of the consequences. Let's also remember that it's one thing to have this information exposed to police forces in a country where ostensibly we have things like due process and the rule of law. But in much of the world, we don't have such niceties protecting us. And Google is still operating with the same sort of data surveillance around the world and subjecting many, many people to oppression just for its own ability to target ads a little bit better.
It's interesting to me because this article also points to the very tight relationship, the like inextricably intertwined relationship between government surveillance and corporate surveillance. And we need to remember that when we talk about protecting our civil liberties from government overreach, to not also talk about corporate surveillance is somewhat disingenuous.
Exactly.
So that does it for my tab this week. But yeah, Wikipedia is a great one. And that New York Times article is something I really recommend people taking the time to read. That does it for our show. You can email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, gripes. Just say hi. We love to hear from you. You can follow me and Siva on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser, and Siva is at Siva Vade. It's SivaVaid. Thanks again to our guest, Andy Greenberg. You can follow him on Twitter at @A_Greenberg. And thanks to everyone who's left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. We really appreciate your time in leaving us a 5-star glowing review. If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. If you want more of Slate's tech coverage, sign up for the Future Tense newsletter. Every week, you'll get news and commentary on how tech advances are changing the world in ways small and large. Sign up at slate.com/future news. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Thanks to Jonas Strauss at Survivor Sound here in Oakland. Thanks to Robert Armengol at the studios of the Virginia Quarterly Review, a cool magazine that Siva is also a part of. So many projects on his plate. I will see y'all next week, and Siva will also be joining me next week. So please continue to tune in. It's been a lot of fun having him.
Yeah, and thanks, everyone.